for each positions, and the killing and assassinations of leadership of Islamic Republic is not something new. Killing of the head of the state is new. This had not happened for a long time, or in Islamic Republic. But up to the level of president, we have had senior leadership of Islamic Republic being assassinated in 1980s, and they have been replaced. So I don't think the regime has changed, because these are the new leadership is not coming from outside the regime. In most cases, such as Mojtaba Khamenei, that is now the new leader, or Zulqad, that became the secretary of the High Council for National Security, the new leadership have been even more hawkish than previous leadership. So it is, in some way, it is true that the leadership has changed and it has become more hardline and hawkish.
We're going to continue this discussion and post online at democracynow.org with Professor Ali Khadivar, fellow at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Studies at Harvard University, associate professor of sociology and international studies at Boston College. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for our development associate position to support our fundraising team. Learn more at democracynow.org. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. This is another edition of Democracy Now!
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Love KBOO Community Radio and its mission? Step up and apply to join the board of directors. KBOO's board leads the station, shaping its future, representing member voices, safeguarding its financial health, and sustaining the independence of community radio. Every KBOO member can run for the board, and we especially encourage BIPOC members to apply. Want to learn more? Join an upcoming board information session held online via video conference from now through June. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/recruitment26.
What does the average KBOO listener think of self-help radio?
This is so hard and complicated.
I have no idea what it is.
What's this old-time music?
I feel so proud of myself.
It seems kind of worthless.
Why does it have to make so much noise?
It sounds very hipster.
That's the worst thing.
Look at how humanity has used their intellect.
Self-help radio, a different theme explored with music and talk every week. Tuesdays, midnight to 3 a.m. on KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, 30,000 Portlanders join the No Kings rally over the weekend.
Over 100 shelter beds in Portland will be unavailable as a local homeless nonprofit goes under.
And the online resource Wikipedia bans the use of AI on its site.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 30th, 2026. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Josh Salem. 30,000 Portlanders gathered at the waterfront, South Waterfront, on Saturday for the third No Kings protest against the Trump administration. Demonstrators heard speeches and marched down NATO Parkway, across the Steel Bridge, past the Convention Center, and back across the Burnside Bridge in the afternoon. Another group of protesters, led by artist Mark Schneider, used umbrellas to spell out a message from above on the Burnside Bridge, "We Protect Us." Speakers called on demonstrators to join other community-led actions, including a nationwide general strike planned for May 1st, or May Day. Later in the show, on KBOO News in Depth at 5:30, we'll hear from No Kings demonstrations around the Portland metro area. Inflatable costumes were less of a presence than the No Kings protest in October, but like that rally, a big emphasis for protesters was Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Other signs protested the U.S. war on Iran or called for the full release of the Epstein files. Last week, a federal court issued a stay on an order that would have prevented ICE from using tear gas against Portlanders outside their facility on the South Waterfront. That means federal officers can use chemical agents against demonstrators. On Saturday evening, they did not use tear gas on the few hundred protesters outside the building. Those gathered damaged the rolling gate of the building, and police arrested three people after declaring a riot around 10 p.m.
Over 100 shelter beds in northeast Portland are slated for closure or relocation in the coming months. The beds are managed by a nonprofit contractor, Sunstone Way, a homeless shelter operator in the Portland area. The contractor has a checkered financial track record dating back to 2022. The Oregonian reports Sunstone Way is slated to dissolve in July due to financial insolvency. Earlier this year, Sunstone Way was accused by its former financial director, Kate Fulton, of financial mismanagement. The accusation culminated in a $4.5 million tort case of whistleblower retaliation that is currently open in Multnomah County Civil Court. Sunstone Way denies the charges, but regardless of the case's outcome, the contractor will shut down. Nearly 40 beds from a shelter in the Lloyd neighborhood will be transferred to other shelters or held for future use. However, all 96 beds in the Centennial neighborhood shelter will be decommissioned. The larger shelter usually operated at a fraction of its capacity. A third site on NATO Parkway will be administered by Transition Projects. Multnomah County is seeking new management for the remaining two shelters in the Delta Park and Rockwood neighborhoods. These closures take place in the context of Mayor Wilson's campaign to aggressively address the city's homelessness problem. In December, the city announced that it had reached its goal of providing 1,500 emergency shelter beds, and the mayor announced his intention to pivot towards transitioning homeless Portlanders into long-term housing. Need for emergency shelter in Portland typically peaks during the winter, so the impact of these closures may be softened for the next few months. However, accelerating climate change increased demand for summer shelters as people seek relief from heat waves like the one that killed 72 Portlanders in 2021. At the latest report, these are roughly 3,500 shelter units in Portland, serving a homeless population of nearly 10,000.
Despite the Trump administration's claims that immigrants are straining the country's resources, data show they pay significantly more in taxes than they receive in public services. New research says in the last 30 years, immigrants contributed over $14 trillion more than they received in benefits. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
Immigrants pay far more in taxes than they use in public services, according to data from the Cato Institute, a Washington, D.C.-based libertarian think tank. Its report finds that between 1994 and 2023, immigrants contributed $14.5 trillion more in federal, state, and local taxes than they cost the government in social services, like healthcare and education. Alejandro Caral with the Oregon Center for Public Policy says the findings contradict the common Trump administration message that immigrants are depleting the country's resources.
The reality is that there is a significant benefit that immigrants bring to our economy, not to mention how integral immigrants are to the fabric of the community, to the culture of those communities.
Caral explains that immigrants, regardless of their legal status, pay taxes but don't receive benefits like unemployment and Social Security. He adds immigrants have an overall positive fiscal impact because they're likely to be of working age and also have less access to benefits for older adults like pensions. Caral adds immigrants in Oregon account for 13% of the state's economic output, which is disproportionately higher than their population. He says, contrary to the Trump administration view, expanding pathways to gain legal status would create more stability for the state's economy.
If you don't have the workers ready to pick those crops, the economic impact is going to be significant. And so having that certainty through a legal pathway will actually help businesses and will have a positive net effect on the economy.
Caral praises Oregon for adopting policies that support immigrant communities like the Earned Income Tax Credit and Oregon Kids Credit. He says, when these workers are more supported, then employers can depend more on their labor. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Wikipedia bans the use of artificial intelligence on its online encyclopedia. The site is supported by a community of volunteer editors, and the use of AI and large language models has been contentious. In the policy change, Wikipedia says that large language models, or LLMs, often violate the site's core principles. Those are a neutral point of view, verifiability, and no original research. Large language models have a pattern of hallucinating results and serving them to readers. That likely runs afoul of the verifiability principle. There are two exceptions. AI can be used for translations and minor copy edits. The policy reads, quote, editors are permitted to use LLMs to suggest basic copy edits to their own writing and to incorporate some of them after human review, provided the LLM does not introduce content of its own. Caution is required because LLMs can go beyond what you ask of them and change the meaning of the text such that it is not supported by the source cited, end quote.
More than 8 million people attend thousands of No Kings protests. Fissures appear among MAGA supporters over the Iran war. And the RNC is suing Delaware for access to its voter rolls. With those stories and more, it's Simone Perez with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
As Americans, we will never forsake our heritage. We will never accept authoritarianism. We will never accept oligarchy.
Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders addressing thousands at the St. Paul, Minnesota No Kings rally. Organizers estimate 8 to 9 million people attended the 3,000 protests nationwide Saturday, the largest single-day demonstrations in U.S. history, surpassing the record 5 and 7 million at the two previous No Kings events. Vice President J.D. Vance won more than half of the vote at the Conservative Political Action Conference annual presidential straw poll, suggesting he's ahead in the contest to lead MAGA after President Donald Trump. Vance's share is actually down compared to the last straw poll. Secretary of State Marco Rubio had been in single digits a year ago, but won support for more than a third of CPAC delegates this time. The conference was divided on the Iran war, especially over the use of ground troops. Former White House strategist and America First isolationist Steve Bannon said people still have to be convinced.
Particularly now that we're on the eve of potentially the insertion of American combat troops. Your sons, daughters, granddaughters, grandsons could be on Karg Island or be holding a beachhead.
The hesitancy among MAGA seems to be eroding Trump's normal party dominance. A Pew Research poll found that about two-thirds of Republican-leaning voters approved of his war policies, down some. Democrats may have an opening in Vance's native state of Ohio. Both Cook Political Report and Sabato's Crystal Ball have moved that governor's race from solid to lean Republican. Strategists suggest likely GOP nominee Vivek Ramaswamy may not appeal to anti-immigrant MAGA voters. Two jury verdicts against Meta and YouTube could mean trouble for big tech. A jury in California fined the social media giants $6 million for defective products, and another in New Mexico awarded plaintiffs nearly $400 million after finding Meta liable for compromising children's safety. Women's health advocates warned that rural West Virginia women are losing access to essential reproductive care. The state passed a near-total abortion ban in 2022, and along with cuts to Medicaid, that's driving OBGYNs out of the state. Emily Wimbledorf, with Planned Parenthood South Atlantic, says nearly half of West Virginia counties are now maternity care deserts. She says hospitals and clinics have closed their birthing wards and doctors are frightened.
It means that providers are scared to provide the care in their communities that they know people need because they're being threatened of losing their medical license, of all of these different repercussions.
The Republican National Committee has sued for access to Delaware's voter registration lists, arguing it's aiming to ensure accuracy. In North Carolina, Michigan, and Arizona, the RNC have pushed states to purge voter lists, and it has similar lawsuits active in Maryland, New Jersey, Hawaii, and Nevada. I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
The Trump administration will convene a rarely used committee this week to consider an exemption to a bedrock environmental law that would allow oil and gas drilling in the Gulf of Mexico to proceed despite risks to endangered species. Tramell Gomes has more in Florida.
The Endangered Species Act has helped bring some Florida animals and plants back from the brink, from the Florida panther to the West Indian manatee. But the Trump administration could change that as soon as this week. It's convening a special committee, nicknamed the God Squad, to pursue an exemption that would allow Gulf drilling without full consideration of its impact on wildlife. One species at risk is the Rhesus whale. with only about 50 remaining. Mary Lou Flores with the Endangered Species Coalition says the law has been a bedrock of conservation.
The Endangered Species Act has really been the cornerstone conservation law that has really helped us protect numerous species, including the American bald eagle, over the course of its existence. And so it really does play a very special role in conservation in South Florida.
The God Squad has only been convened 3 times in nearly 50 years. Critics say the administration is bypassing required steps, including public hearings. A federal judge has allowed the meeting to proceed, but the legal challenge continues. The meeting is set for Tuesday at the U.S. Interior Department in Washington, D.C. The meeting is scheduled to be live-streamed on YouTube. Flores says species across the Southeast face mounting pressure from development, pollution, and aging infrastructure. She points to the West Indian manatee as another example.
West Indian manatees have been suffering from starvation in numerous parts of Florida. There was actually a feeding program that was established by the state of Florida to try and bolster their nutritional supplements because seagrass beds have died off due to pollution and algal blooms and have left them starving.
According to a letter signed in January by 87 members of Congress, the Endangered Species Act has prevented more than 99% of listed species from going extinct. They urged the Trump administration to withdraw proposals they say would weaken the law. This is Tramell Gomes for Florida News Connection.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on Saturday's No Kings protests in the Portland metro area. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear, with an overnight low of 37. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a high of 54. Today in history, in 1867, U.S. Secretary of State William Seward purchases Alaska from Russia for about 2 cents an acre, for a total of $7 million. The quote of the day is from Dutch painter Vincent van Gogh, born this day in 1853. He said, "It is better to be high-spirited, even though one makes more mistakes, than to be narrow-minded and all too prudent. It is good to love many things, for therein lies the true strength. And whosoever loves much performs much and can accomplish much, and what is done in love is well done."
Congressional lawmakers are considering an update to a housing law for tribal nations. It comes at a critical time as tribal communities face widespread housing shortages. With that story and more, it's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas. Lawmakers in Washington are proposing to update a key housing law for tribal nations as communities across Indian country continue to face severe housing shortages. Last week, Montana Congressman Troy Downing introduced the American Housing and Self-Determination Modernization Act. The legislation would modernize and reauthorize the Native American Housing Assistance and Self-Determination Act, known as NAHASDA, which provides federal funding for tribal housing programs, but it has not been fully reauthorized in more than a decade. Downing said in a press release that, quote, "Homeownership is the foundation of the American dream. That doesn't stop with Americans in our tribal communities." The new act would increase funding and give tribes more flexibility to build, repair, and manage housing, Downing says. He says that across Indian country, many Native families are living in overcrowded homes, with multiple generations sharing limited space. Mark Macaro, president of the National Congress of American Indians, says in a prepared statement that, quote, "The time to reauthorize and modernize NAHASDA is now," end quote. Other supporters of the act, quoted in a press release, say the changes are long overdue. Senators Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Brian Schatz of Hawaii are leading similar legislation in the Senate. Skiku is a nonprofit that brings skiing to communities across rural Alaska. This year, organizers tried something new to make the activity stick, training a village resident to be a coach. As Eliona Niden reports for the Alaska Desk, the idea is to encourage kids to ski throughout winter.
Justin River Lechton was a fifth grade student in Aniak in southwest Alaska when he learned to ski. He loved it and started going out on the river with his dogs, breaking trail, and enjoying the freedom the activity brought him.
It brought me outdoors. It took me, you know, outside to the nature, and I was just enjoying it so much.
Now, Lechton is 21 and becoming a ski coach. In February, he joined the nonprofit Skiku, which taught him how to ski and has been bringing the sport to kids across Alaska. Together, he and the Skiku team traveled to several interior villages, Grayling, Anwick, and Shagalak. The February trip culminated with a week in another community in the same region, Holy Cross, where Lechton now lives. There, he ran the show. Next winter, he will be the coach for Holy Cross kids.
They're mostly inside. You know, it'd be great to get them outside and to do something outdoors all together as a team, you know.
Skiku has been around for more than a decade, bringing cross-country ski coaches and equipment to kids in Alaska villages. Tyler Hennigan is its executive director. He says usually after the visit, the skis go back to the closet. Hennigan says what's missing is an adult who will take the kids out
to kind of keep those communities shredding. In my mind, I have like a Jedi Padawan situation, where like we can kind of have that person mentor those folks out there and really kind of hope to make something a little more sustainable too, that's really more community driven.
That's where Lechton comes in, to keep it going throughout the season. Santa Hamilton Roach says that children in her region stay active by hauling wood and working outside, but she says they don't get many chances to try themselves in competitive sports. And Roach is happy all four villages in her area are part of this project.
We're all the same people trying to live good, healthy, quality lives in our communities. And when you really see our tribes come together, we could do cool things.
The organizers say they hope to find more residents like Lechton to keep kids skiing throughout the season. In Anchorage, I'm Alona Knighton.
And I'm Jill Freitas.
It's something families might plan for, but when an older relative needs care at home, loved ones' expenses and responsibilities can serve as a sobering reality of how much goes into it. A national consumer and senior advocacy group has new estimates on the sizable economic value linked to this unpaid care. Mike Moen shares the details in North Dakota.
North Dakotans who put in a lot of unpaid labor caring for a loved one aren't alone, as a new national report places that economic value at $1 trillion. The latest estimate comes from AARP's policy arm, which factors in contributions from the nation's 59 million family caregivers. That work includes daily tasks from meals, bathing, and dressing to transportation and coordination of medical and social services. Altogether, the authors say that mostly unpaid labor represents an average value of just over $20 an hour of care. Josh Askvig with AARP North Dakota points out that for many, the effort comes from a place of love.
They are the ones that are being called upon to keep their loved ones safe and independent, but it does have an economic toll.
Askwig says it would be hard for society to pay for all this care, but he reminds North Dakotans to take advantage of the state's Family Member Care Tax Credit to help offset added expenses they're taking on. This financial tool does have income and recipient requirements, which affects eligibility. Advocates have been calling for a tax credit at the federal level to complement state-level relief. AARP's Chief Engagement Officer Nancy Lamond says the time for action is now.
Family caregivers are the backbone of our long-term care system. This is not just a family issue, it's a labor force issue, an economic issue, and a healthcare system issue.
A key bill in Congress, the Credit for Caring Act, has bipartisan support, but has seen little activity in the past year. The latest AARP report says the economic value of unpaid caregiving now exceeds healthcare spending by private businesses, along with federal, state, and local Medicaid spending. This is Mike Moen for Prairie News Service.
Federal research finds about one-third of Washington children aren't ready for kindergarten when the time comes, and that number increases for kids in rural areas. One organization is working in rural communities across Washington and nationally to help close the early education gap through home visiting programming. Isabel Charlet reports.
About one-third of young children are not ready for kindergarten in Washington state, according to a federal survey. The data also show children from lower-income families and rural communities lag further behind their wealthier peers by up to 25%. Amy Barlay, Washington State Director of Save the Children, says the organization's home visiting program is working to fill the gaps. She says the program uses evidence-based curriculum to help children be ready for kindergarten by offering lessons, books, and group learning opportunities for kids from birth to age five.
What we've heard from kindergarten teachers about children who've been in our program is that they come into the kindergarten classroom more confident. They have those kindergarten readiness skills intact. They're just ready to learn.
Barlay says limited engagement with peers and lack of access to libraries and other services can leave young children behind in social and academic skills when they start school. And she says they need a variety of skills to be able to start kindergarten, from basic knowledge of letters and numbers to experience making friends. Tracy Kenny, also with Save the Children, says focusing on kindergarten preparedness is critical for laying a healthy foundation for a child's life. She says 90% of a child's brain is developed by age six, and research shows those who are in high-quality early learning programs graduate from high school on time at higher rates than their peers.
And they're also much less likely to repeat a grade level or be convicted of a crime, which ultimately leads to higher expected lifetime earnings.
Barlay emphasizes that parents don't need anything special to support a young child's development. She recommends families build learning opportunities into their daily routines,
such as cooking dinner, talking about how many family members there are, how many forks you need, when you're in the grocery store, counting the number of apples, pointing out colors.
I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
The so-called American dream is becoming harder to achieve, according to one professor. He blames a combination of stagnant wages, rising costs, and growing inequality. He argues that restoring opportunity through investments in education, healthcare, and childcare is critical. Simone Perez has more in Virginia.
A professor argues that the traditional idea of the American dream has fallen out of reach in modern times. Recent polling mirrors this view, as more than half of Virginians and people across the country say they're worse off than a few years ago. Washington University in St. Louis professor Mark Rank says economic security, personal fulfillment, and hope for a better future are all key parts of the dream, which people assume they could achieve through hard work. But Rank says stagnant wages and big cost of living hikes have dampened their optimism.
This idea of more and more people falling behind in terms of the American dream really explains a lot of the disillusionment, a lot of the frustration, a lot of the anxiety that people are experiencing in this country today.
A poll by Virginia Commonwealth University found nearly 6 in 10 people were concerned about the cost of living and inflation as prices on goods such as gas continue to rise. More than half of Americans also voice concerns that economic growth in the U.S. doesn't benefit everyone equally. Rank says improving equal opportunity through investments in education, childcare, and healthcare will be needed to make the American dream more attainable.
I think we absolutely can do that, but what we really need is the political will. That's the problem. There's a lot of gridlock, nothing seems to be getting done, and we need to move forward, especially thinking about the 250th anniversary of this country and where we want to go in the future.
Ultimately, Rank emphasizes that hope for a better future is essential. Without it, he says the nation is at greater risk. I'm Simone Perez, Virginia News Connection.
Low electricity rates don't always mean low bills. Rates matter, but energy efficiency makes a big difference too. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In recent years, the price of electricity in the U.S. has gone up, in some states faster than inflation. But the price per kilowatt is only part of what determines your total bill.
Your bill depends on the price you're paying and then also how much you're consuming.
Ryan Ledeck is with the Brattle Group, which partnered with Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory to analyze electricity prices nationwide.
In a state like California, which has some of the highest prices in the U.S., parts of California also tend to have relatively mild climates, and California also has a history of pretty strong energy efficiency policies. So the average customer in California uses less than your average U.S. customer.
As a result, their bills are similar to states like Alabama and Mississippi that have lower rates but higher usage. In these and some other southeastern states, people use a lot of electricity for AC in the summer. Many homes use electric heat in winter, and these states have fewer policies and programs to improve energy efficiency. So even in states where rates have not risen as much, many families struggle to pay their bills, and helping people invest in energy efficiency can provide some relief. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 30th, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Gian Guanta, Hannah Francis, Lizak Shellett, Stuart Duncan, and Laurie W. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Nick Caperso. Special thanks to Jill Freitas, Simone Perez, Isabel Charlet, Mike Moen, Anna Wilcox, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Dave Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We're bringing you the sounds of this weekend's No Kings protest.